Let's go outside. I'm here in Washington, D.C. today, which is, of course, home to the federal government. But this time of year, one of the biggest draws is nature. Cherry blossoms that surround the tidal basin next to the memorial to Thomas Jefferson. The National Park Service estimates that more than a million people gathered to see the cherry blossoms last Saturday. I stopped by yesterday to visit with the Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell. Our first stop was a new kiosk that Jewell is installing in national parks to allow visitors to video chat with visitors at other parks. She steps up to talk with some kids visiting the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta.
Hi there. Who am I saying hi to?
Sierra.
Hi. Sierra and what?
Nanai.
Nanai. Are you coming to visit the park?
They came all the way from Connecticut.
Wow, from Connecticut?
The connection isn't great, but Jewell says the kiosks are crucial to getting young people interested in visiting the national parks.
What this is all about is using technology not to disconnect people from nature, but to connect them. So a little hard to hear the audio on that, but as we perfect technology, it's going to give us a chance to give people an experience, perhaps, with parks that they haven't seen before and maybe inspire them to get off the couch and out of in front of the screen and come out and visit.
Show them the parks that they don't know about or that they might visit in the future.
Inspire them to visit parks in the future. It's 407 units of the National Park Service, and people might think of the iconic national parks like the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone, but they don't realize that there's a national park that commemorates the life and the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, there's a national park right here, the National Mall, which is the nation's front yard, which really invites people to learn about our history and our culture. And of those 407 units, they tell all kinds of stories, and we want people to know about them.
So people are going to hear you say that and wonder, are people not going to the parks? Is there a problem? What's going on? Why do they need to educate everyone about the parks?
Well, there's no question we have great levels of visitation to the national parks, and we hit records in 2014. But when you look at our visitors, they aren't representative of the whole population of the U.S. We're underrepresented with minorities in our parks. They tend to be older visitors and not younger visitors, and younger visitors are really tied into technology, and using that technology to connect them to parks is a way where we hope to drive visitation that's more reflective of the American population.
Why do you think that is, that younger people aren't going to the parks as much?
Well, we're urbanizing as a population, and young people are really busy. Most of the time, they're spending time during their day being told what to do by an adult. In school, on a soccer field or a basketball court someplace, or maybe in a karate class or ballet classes, they are being given very little time to get outside and explore on their own. And so for many of them, by their parents' busy schedules and their busy schedules, they're just getting more and more disconnected from public lands and open spaces and parks and nature. And we want to be part of the solution to turn that around.
What do you say to people who don't like any technology in the parks? They're not going to be happy with this. They weren't happy when you put more cell towers in some of the national parks.
I would say that they make assumptions about how people are using technology that may not be accurate and up with the times. I have children, they've been digital natives themselves, and I FaceTime with my new little grandson, and it's an opportunity to use technology to keep us connected as human beings. And so if you allow people to use their technology, something that they're really comfortable with, we think that it will engage them more in the space as opposed to disconnect them. I will tell you, I've heard many park rangers talk of the stories of having kids that are zoomed into their technology on a video game, and then pretty soon, the deeper they get into a park or the deeper they get on a paddling trip, the more they look up and realize what's going on around them, and then they use their devices for different purposes, like taking pictures and sending them to their friends on Snapchat or, you know, whatever they're using. So we want to embrace it.
Why do you have a problem bringing more minorities, as you say, into the national parks?
Well, I would say here in Washington, D.C., among the cherry blossoms, we welcome a broad diversity that's probably pretty reflective of the population of Washington, D.C. and the city broadly. But when you get to more remote national parks, many families have not had a tradition of going out taking long family vacations. They may live in urban areas. It's not been just part of how they've chosen to recreate. And yet, as we urbanize as a population and as we become more diverse, we will need advocates in the future. They will be sitting in the halls of Congress. They'll be on county councils and city councils and state legislatures, and they will be reflective of the population. So we need to make sure that our parks are relevant and welcoming and accessible to all Americans. And while maybe in Anacostia Park in Washington, D.C., and on the National Mall, we have broad diversity, that's not true across the country, and we believe we have some work to do to make sure that people recognize these are their parks.
Jewel points to the success of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, as connecting a previous generation to public lands, which she says laid the groundwork for the support the national parks have had over the decades. As we walk along the tidal basin, park rangers come up and show their adoration for Jewel, but she says not everyone is a fan of hers.
Well, I think when you're running the Department of Interior, you're balancing an awful lot of competing interests. Protecting lands, but also allowing access to our natural resources. Part of the mission of the Park Service is to protect these special assets unimpaired for future generations, and yet you need to allow people to come and visit. And so how do you strike that right balance on the right level of visitation, but also leaving them unimpaired for future generations? And that's tricky. So we're always trying to strike a balance between how much we love our parks and how much we protect our parks. And that's true for my broad portfolio in Department of Interior as well.
Well, and there are others who would say they want to be able to do more drilling. They want to be able to get access to the resources that are being protected.
Yeah, that's true. I will say that in national parks, there is no drilling and we do protect the resources. But there are a lot of public lands in the Department of Interior's portfolio and the Federal Family Forest Service, for example, that don't have any levels of protection or very minimal levels of protection. And some of them are appropriate for development of resources because they don't have other special attributes to them, and others are too special to develop. So I'll use the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as an example. It's a wildlife refuge. It was set up for that purpose. There is probably oil and gas under there, but we do not believe that's appropriate to develop, and we've made that position clear as an administration. There's also a National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. It's got some special places that we've put off limits for oil and gas activities, but it's got a lot of the land that is appropriate for oil and gas activity and also has resources. So that's part of how I balance this job.
Well, do you think that right now, the way that things are set up and what's protected and what's not protected, that we have the right balance right now?
No, I think that we need to continue to do a better job of pulling up and understanding our landscapes. So, for example, when Yellowstone National Park was set aside in the late 1800s, we set it aside for the areas that we knew were special, the geothermal features and those kinds of things. And the reality is we now understand that Yellowstone's ecosystem is much bigger than what we have just with Yellowstone National Park. So it's been a very concentrated effort for many years, something called Crown of the Continent, to connect protected areas and corridors where wildlife can migrate, for example, and the ecosystem can thrive that goes well outside the park's boundaries. And that is by working with private landowners and conservation easements and conservation organizations, as well as the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, other landowners in that corridor, to recognize that there are areas that needed more protection than we'd had in the past. So as we get smarter, as we understand our landscapes more, we need to continue to adjust our land management practices.
I should say, as we're talking here, we're walking past the cherry blossoms, which I guess we missed the peak by a few days, but they're still pretty lovely.
Yes, gorgeous.
What about maintenance? You're not dealing with an enormous budget at the Department of the Interior, and a report last month from the Park Service found that the agency had to delay a lot of maintenance projects, $11.5 billion worth. How do you get Congress to give you the money that you need to maintain the parks?
Well, we need to make a case for the parks, and so do constituents, so that members of Congress recognize this is a priority for the people in their districts and the people in their states. We do have an $11.5 billion maintenance backlog. Half of that is transportation. So you think about the crumbling roads and bridges that people travel on across the country. That is very true in national parks, and that would have been funded out of a transportation package that we are about to run out of money on. So that's one illustration. Congress passes legislation that increases the number of national parks, but we have not now for a number of years increased the budget to address that maintenance and operation, and I think it's critically important that we do so.
Well, and I was surprised to hear, by the way, that
80% of Americans know about the National Park Service, but less than half that number can actually tell you what they do.
I think that's true. I mean, maybe 80% of the Americans can say there is a National Park Service, but I would say a small fraction, much less than half, can actually name a lot of the national parks that are probably quite close to where they are. Many of them tell stories of our culture and our history. I think they think about iconic large national parks, but they don't think about the Civil War battlefields or the Revolutionary War battlefields or the stories of the Underground Railroad or the Civil Rights Movement. And these are all stories that are told in the national parks all around the country. So part of the Find Your Park campaign is going to be challenging people to take a look and recognize there's some really very close by.
The Find Your Park campaign is Jewel's initiative to get Americans, especially young Americans, to realize the parks that are around them. In front of the Jefferson Memorial, there's a digital kiosk that allows you to video chat with visitors at other parks. You can also spin a dial in any direction, and it'll tell you how far you are from the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone. We were just feet away from the monument to FDR.
Let's walk over here for a second. Let me just show you. The bread line that they have from the Great Depression. And at the top he says, "I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished." He says, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." So that's a good illustration of the Great Depression and what was driving his thought process at that time. And if we walk this way, you'll see the formation of the CCC and his vision for putting young American men to work on our public lands. And some of them are still living. They're in their 90s now. But the experience in the CCC shaped who they are. And that's very much something that we're trying to bring back right now, is a connection from young people to public lands through service.
This is something that obviously means a lot to you.
It's true.
What is it that just made you feel that way?
I see our country polarizing. I see people with opportunity. I had opportunity, my kids had opportunity, and I see a lot of people without opportunity. I've been out on hundreds of service projects with young people who have done work on public lands, and it has changed their lives. That's what happened in the CCC. That's what can happen today. The work in nature and on public lands gives people inspiration to see careers that they otherwise have not seen. It gives puts things like park rangers and wildlife biologists and historians and caretakers of the land on the radar of people that don't see those jobs in their future, and I think that's very important. So he says, "I propose to create a civilian conservation corps to be used in simple work. More important, however, than the material gains will be the moral and spiritual value of such work." He recognized that a large unemployed citizenry or underemployed citizenry destroyed their confidence, and that giving them work would give them both moral and spiritual value. And as I look at the challenges that we had in our Great Recession on employment, and I look at the challenges of young people as they put themselves through school, which is very expensive today, they get out of school and they're looking for meaningful work, that's difficult. We'll say that in the Youth Corps work that I have done with the kids that have led me, whether I'm pulling invasive species or building trail, that I see in them strong moral and spiritual values and a sense of confidence they wouldn't have otherwise have had.
Is it time to renew that, to do that again, in a way to, especially at a time when youth unemployment is so high in this country?
I think it is, and I will say that we're doing that. In the Department of Interior, we have a youth initiative. I don't have enough money in the budget to support it, and so I've gone to the private sector, and companies have stepped up. Companies like American Eagle Outfitters, which was first to the table. Companies like American Express and REI and Coca-Cola, Camelback, a number of them have said, "We're willing to support your work." And we're working with the nonprofit community as well. So The official name is the 21st Century Conservation Service Corps. I like to call it CCC 2.0. It's saying, okay, maybe the federal government's not going to write a check to get all these underemployed or unemployed young people out working on public lands, but maybe the private sector can help, and they are. So it's another way that they're working not only to support Youth Conservation Corps crews, which we are putting to work, but they're also engaging their employees in coming out and volunteering, and they're giving these young people a hiring preference when they're done. And all of those things are really important because, you know, we want young people to feel great about the opportunities that they have.
Sally Jewell, thank you so much.
Thank you.